This is an ABC Radio National podcast. For full details, abc.net.au/rn.
Tell me, how would you feel going out at night to see nothing but pitch black, only the moon and a few stars to shed any light at all? Would you feel frightened? Would you feel safe? It's amazing how much simple street lamps have changed our culture, made policing effective, shortened our sleep, and as Trevor McAllister notes, turned dinner in the evening into the main meal in most households. And this lighting is so incredibly recent, just a handful of generations old.
On 17th December 1855, the unpopular Governor of Victoria, Sir Charles Hotham, ceremonially lit the first fire under the retorts at the new Melbourne Gas Works on the river at the western end of the city. It was a bleak, wintry day, and Sir Charles caught a cold, which added to the unhappiness of his lot as the governor of the turbulent new Gold Rush colony. Sydney had had a gasworks since 1841, when Melbourne was just a remote colonial village. But now, with the Gold Rush boom, Melbourne would have many establishments requiring the new gas lights. Since 1842, there had been a mechanics institute in Collins Street, and the new university in Carlton had admitted its first students only the previous April. In 1856, the new free public library would open in Swanston Street, and Parliament House would rise in Spring Street on the hill at the eastern end of town. Down the hill, the actor-manager George Coppin would create Melbourne's Theatreland. He already owned the Olympic in Stephen Street, was shortly to install gaslight in Astley's Amphitheatre in Spring Street, and would then take over the Theatre Royal in Bourke Street. The gas retorts lit by Sir Charles were iron containers packed with coal. All the components of the gas plant and the coal itself had been imported from Britain, as had His Excellency. Coal is mostly carbon, with some hydrogen and oxygen, a little nitrogen and sulphur. On heating, it yields the gases carbon monoxide and hydrogen, leaving behind solid coke, which can also be burned as a fuel and used by steelworks to reduce iron ore. The gases were collected in large, ugly gas holders, made of concentric cylindrical sections floating in a tank of water, rising and falling with the amount of gas. Early gaslight illuminated by the same principle as the candle or the oil lamp. Michael Faraday showed that it is the hot carbon particles released by the burning of candle wax which glow incandescently. But gas is a simpler fuel than candle wax or oil, as it does not have to be melted or vaporized, and it can be readily piped to many outlets. Flammable gas had been known for centuries, leaking out of the ground near coal mines. This gas would have been methane, or fire damp, as the miners called it. In 1684, the Reverend John Clayton, rector of Crofton, while investigating one such leak bubbling from a flooded ditch near Wigan, realised the connection between the gas and the coal underground, and experimented with heating coal in a sealed container, collecting the gas in a bladder, and burning it as a party trick for his friends. There was less urgency to publish in those days, and Clayton's account of these experiments, communicated by letter to his friend Robert Boyle of the Royal Society, finally appeared in Philosophical Transactions in 1739. In the 18th century, the increased demand for coke to produce steel resulted in more industrial carbonisation of coal. But the gas produced was regarded as a nuisance and flared off. Then more practical men began to experiment with useful applications. William Murdoch, a young Scot, was employed by the industrial pioneers Boulton and Watt in 1777 to be their agent in Cornwall, where the tin mines were the chief market for their steam engines. William Murdoch was not only interested in steam engines, and by 1792 he had made a small coal gas plant to light his house. Boulton and Watt let him illuminate their Soho factory in Birmingham to celebrate the short-lived peace with the French in 1802, but were reluctant to promote the new process beyond their factory for fear of accidents which might reflect on their reputation as steam engineers. It took the entrepreneurial zeal of Albert Vintzler, an immigrant from Central Europe, to popularise the benefits of gas to light streets and houses. In 1807, he illuminated a section of the Mall with lights supplied by pipes from his own domestic gas plant. The formation of the London Gas Light and Coke Company took another 5 years. There was much opposition. Many were the fears of fires and explosions, of pipes glowing red hot in the streets, and noxious fumes in the vicinity of gasworks. Eventually, the first gasworks was built at Cannon Row in Westminster, and the nearby Westminster Bridge was lighted in 1813. The first theatre to use gaslight was Covent Garden in 1815. Before gas, Covent Garden had chandeliers in the auditorium, which used 270 candles every night, and there were 300 oil lamps on the stage, and another 300 in the staircases and corridors. These had all required regular trimming of wicks, cleaning of lamp glasses, and replenishing with oil, so that a full-time lamp man had to be employed. The spread of gas lighting in Europe and America transformed social life. Dinner became an evening meal, and the new middle classes could venture out at night as gaslit streets were safer. Theatres became more popular, although ladies long felt that the whiter, brighter gaslight was unkind to their complexions compared with candlelight. For aspiring workers, there was self-improvement at night classes, but there was also the disadvantage that the evening shift in factories could be extended into the winter months. The first cotton mill to get gas lights was Messrs. Philip and Lee of Manchester, for whom Boulton and Watt made a gas plant in 1805. It was, we can now see, the start of the trend towards the 24/7 society. Although gas light was regarded as a great improvement on the candle, we would think those early hissing bat's wing gas flames dim compared with our electric light. Nevertheless, reading was to benefit greatly. Skylights or tall windows were important in the design of early libraries. In the Melbourne Public Library in 1856, the uncluttered walls of the Renaissance Revival design allowed large windows, and the British Museum Reading Room of 1857 had beautiful, tall, arched windows at the base of its dome, as well as the lantern in the apex, to light the studies of its many remarkable readers, such as Karl Marx and Bernard Shaw. Once the natural light from the windows had faded, the library had to close. In the British Museum Reading Room, it was the policy not to have any flame at all, and only the safest of glass-shielded lanterns were used by the attendants in the gathering dusk to chivy the last of the keen-eyed readers from the building. It becomes difficult to distinguish the average printing font if the level of illumination of the book falls below 1 foot candle, that is, a book 1 square foot in area held at a distance of 1 foot from a candle. The early photometric experiments of Bouguer and Lambert in the 18th century used the common light source of their time, the candle, and thus sources of light or levels of illumination came to be measured in units of candle power. Illumination is partly subjective and depends on the colour of the light, but approximately an oil lamp was about twice as bright as a candle, with the early gas lamps as good as oil and requiring no trimming of wicks or refilling of reservoirs every evening. So gas burners could be easily multiplied to provide more light without significantly more domestic work. Public buildings thus saw the introduction of many gas lamps, often in the form of chandeliers, which were renamed gasoliers. By 1829, Covent Garden had converted the chandelier in its auditorium ceiling with two circles of gas lights. Above this was constructed a circular chimney for ventilation, as the interior could become stuffy with the consumption of oxygen in the burning of so much gas. On stage, there were as many gas flames as in the auditorium, in battens, floats and wing lights, all concentrated in a much smaller space. It is hardly surprising that many fires resulted, and some theatres were burnt down several times. Such was the danger that in New South Wales in 1886 there was a royal commission into public safety in Sydney's theatres. The Prince of Wales Opera House had been burned down in 1872, reopening as the Theatre Royal in 1875. Not a lucky name, because George Coppin's Theatre Royal in Bourke Street, Melbourne, had also been destroyed by fire in 1872, and the Sydney Theatre was to burn down again in 1892. The most successful advance in gas lighting for domestic interiors was the Welsbach mantle, invented in 1887. This was a gauze of thorium and cerium oxides, which glow incandescently on being heated by a gas flame, and gave a light which was 2 to 5 times as bright as from the early bat's wing burners. This invention came just in time to save gas lighting from the competition of the new incandescent electric light bulbs, invented by Swan and Edison in 1878. It is these gas mantle lamps which were still to be seen in many city streets in the 1940s, lamps which long required a lamplighter to operate every evening and dawn, and which prompted the famous remark of Edward Grey, British Foreign Secretary, after the short but dramatic first night of the Great War in August 1914. "The lamps are going out all over Europe. They will not be lit again in our lifetime." Grey was right. He died in 1933, whereas the wars precipitated by the events of 1914 lasted until possibly 1989. The old gas supply system had its dangers. The huge, ugly gas holders were quite safe, as long as the water seal was maintained, but gas explosions and fires occurred while searching for leaks in houses and while repairing street mains. But the domestic casualties of gas tended to be poisoned by carbon monoxide, rather than blown up or burned. Lights might go out accidentally as the supply pressure varied. The tendency of gaslight flames to dim and then flare up, as other lamps connected to the same supply were used, featured in the classic movie Gaslight, when the heroine, played by Ingrid Bergman, suspects sinister behaviour on the part of her mysterious husband, played by Charles Boyer, when the gaslights in the house dim, just after he has gone out at night. He has in fact returned to the upper floors of the house to search for the long-lost jewels, for which he has already killed his wife's aunt. Sherlock Holmes had a gas case, The Adventure of the Retired Colour Man. The villain, Josiah Amberley, a retired manufacturer of artist supplies, kills his wife and her lover in the household strongroom by turning on the gas to the light fitting, then covers up the lingering smell of gas by painting the house. Anyone with a sense of smell was unlikely to be accidentally gassed. As Dorothy Parker once famously wrote, "Guns ain't lawful, nooses give. Gas smells awful, you might as well live." Indeed, the smelly nature of coal gas was an unintended safety feature, which had to be reproduced in the 1960s with the new odourless and non-toxic natural gas by stenching with sulphur compounds. The hapless Governor Hotham was to become indirectly the most famous casualty of gas in Australia. The opening of the Melbourne Gasworks turned out to be his last public act. The cold which he caught that day worsened to pneumonia, and he died of the complications on New Year's Eve. The public library and Parliament House were to be opened by the acting governor, Major General Edward MacArthur. The public library got its gaslight in May 1856, just in time for opening hours to be extended from 5 p.m. to 9 p.m. during the winter months, and years before any artificial light was permitted in the British Museum reading room.
Ahead of the Brits once again, Trevor McAllister is a chemist who lives where else in Melbourne. We shall nonetheless visit Britain next week via Margaret River in Western Australia to hear about Elizabeth Barrett Browning from our good Western doctor, Jim Leavesley. I'm Robin Williams.
ABC Radio National. More than 60 programs, more than 260 transmitters Australia-wide. And we're live on the net as well as media on demand streams. Find out how to get more out of Radio National. Go to abc.net.au/rn. And for the full list of MP3 and podcast programs, abc.net.au/rn/podcast.